So welcome to everyone, welcome to those who came back, welcome to those joining for the first time. For those who want to listen to either the previous week's share or also obviously this week's share, they will be available on YU Torah. I have access now, so that'll be uploaded. Hope both last week's and this week's will be uploaded there along with the source sheets. So that will be great. Just to kind of recap what we did last week, we really started to just introduce the idea of minhagim. And part of that was to see how these customs develop, in the sense that what you have is you have in a given generation, you have halacha, you have Jewish law. And from that, different customs will develop. For whatever reason, we'll get more of a sense of that today, but different customs will develop. And then what happens is another generation comes along and it starts to recodify halacha, it starts to re-legislate Jewish law, and it will also take a look at the minhagim that have started to crop up, and it will, in a sense, give a thumbs up, give a thumbs down. There will be a bit of discussion. And so what makes minhagim so fascinating is you have these customs that are arising, but then they are being reanalyzed through the prism of halacha, and really that's what we're going to start to see today also. The different types of minhagim, how they are viewed within the halachic system, how some are treated far more seriously than others. And what we also saw last week was the underpinnings of what makes a minhag. So we saw one potential option is that a minhag is really a neder, an oath, a vow, and along with all the various laws that are associated with making vows and being absolved of vows, or it was potentially almost a separate law of Shema b'ni musar avicha v'al titash tarat emecha, which is from Proverbs, which is do not forsake both the sayings of your father and the Torah of your mother. So one of these is halacha, and one of these is minhag, the customs. And finally, we saw the view of Rav Baruch Simon, which he states at the beginning of his book on minhagim, that it's really a function of the issa of chukat hagoy, the prohibition of copying the other nations. And this is perhaps the strongest articulation of the power of minhagim, because just as we are prohibited from copying the meaningless customs of nations that surround us, so too we are obligated in observing our own almost meaningless customs. So those were kind of the three different perspectives of minhagim. But what I really want to do today is to try and start to classify different types of minhagim. So what we're going to look through all our sources today and try and see is that there's different labels one can assign to a minhag. And when we start to see what those different labels can be, that helps to open up the broader discussion, which we'll get to in the final shir. The fourth shir, which is how bound are we by minhagim, how seriously must we take them, but only by first understanding the broad classifications they can occupy, can we start to understand the seriousness and perhaps the insignificance of some minhagim and others. Obviously, as with any kind of classification system, it's a bit fluid. It's not as clearly black and white as it may seem, and we'll kind of see that. There are some customs that you could maybe give a good argument. Oh, they belong in this classification. Oh, maybe they belong in that classification. But nonetheless, it's still a very helpful system to try and understand, to try to get a better sense of exactly how customs fit within halacha, within Jewish law. So first, before we actually look at them in detail, to list what I basically came up with six rough types of minhagim. We're going to look at five of them today, one of them next week. But the first is minhagim that develop out of stringency, minhagei chumrah. These are to protect a certain value within halacha. They exist to prevent an actual violation of something else. The second type are what are often called minhagei machloket, minhagei psika. These are customs that emerge from halachic decision-making itself. We'll understand what that means very shortly. Then there's customs that create a new practice. There are a bunch of things that weren't originally done in Judaism, and a custom comes along that creates a new practice. Then the one thing we're going to look at next week is customs that define a practice. The most well-known is tefillah, the nusach of tefillah, liturgy. So we're going to spend a whole shir looking at the emergence of that next week. Then there's really, the next two are really customs based on a mistake. And finally, customs that contradict or violate halacha itself. And those kind of already give you a sense of how seriously we treat some of them, but we're really going to now take a look at some of the important details conceptually of each of these types of minhagim, beginning with minhagei chumrah. customs that develop out of a stringency to protect some sort of halachic value. And if you take a look at the source sheet, the first two sources are familiar because we also looked at them last week. We were looking at them last week for a slightly different purpose than what we're looking at them this week, but nonetheless, we'll read through them once again today. And the first source is a Mishnah in Pesachim. And it says the following. Makom shenahagu la'asot melacha ba'arei Pesachim ad chatzot osin. In a place where they are accustomed to doing melacha, to doing work, on Erev Pesach until midday, they may do so. Makom shenahagu shelo la'asot ein osin. In a place where they are not accustomed to do so, they cannot. The context of this is that on Erev Pesach, there are certain obligations. You need to get rid of your chametz. You need to prepare for Seder night. There's a whole laundry list of things you really need to get through on Erev Pesach in order to make sure Pesach goes ahead properly. And so in certain communities, the Mishnah describes, a custom developed where they forbade actual, you know, weekday regular activity in order to ensure that people could do get Erev Pesach done properly. It was treated like, you know, Shabbos in the sense that you weren't allowed to go to work, you weren't allowed to do your regular day job so that you could prepare for Pesach. And yet at the same time, there are other communities described in this Mishnah which did not do that. So what we see here, we're not going to look at the rest of the Mishnah because it's not relevant to what we are looking at, what we're discussing tonight. But ultimately what we see from this first source is this idea that we have the actual halacha, the actual halachic value. Getting Pesach done properly, doing all the various halachot that are required on Erev Pesach, and a custom emerges in order to protect it, in order to draw a fence around those actual values. So we add a chumrah, we add a stringency of no work on Erev Pesach in order to ensure that the actual halachot of Erev Pesach, the actual values of Pesach itself, will be ensured. Yes?
What's the distinction in this case between minhag and a derabbanan? That is, it's, you know, this is also a protective fence. Is it just that nobody, just that this custom came about later than the point at which there was an authority to do it, or it came up organically from the people rather than from above, from the rabbis? Or how do you determine which is which?
So it's a great question, and the sources we'll look at today will start to keep that question as blurred as it is, but for now, our working definition of a custom is it's really something that people are doing. Whether that arises from a rabbinic, not a din derabbanan, not a rabbinic law, but nonetheless rabbis urging their communities to do X or Y, or whether it emerges from the populace, that's a distinction we'll actually start seeing some of these classifications. But what it seems to be for these types of customs, the way they're at least seen in halacha, is that the more important minhagim, the minhagei chumrah, tend to be perceived as arriving with some sort of rabbinic push in place. But it could easily be that the community as a whole just decided to do so. The kind of the nuances of that question, whether the rabbis themselves encouraged the minhag or whether the people themselves started doing it, will be a clearer distinction in some of the later classifications of minhagim.
Right, but the part that you're not speaking to is also what I always thought of as minhag, which is wherever you happen to be, that would determine whether you do it or not. So that implies that it's also something that's like not a communal thing, as opposed to wherever you live, you follow that particular minhag.
So the repeating kind of answer I gave last week's share was share number four.
Okay.
Share number four will address once again. It wasn't the first answer, but it was the second answer to a question. But again, and we'll actually in a couple of sources we'll actually see something that will modify that idea also. But what I just want to focus on right now is this idea that minhagim come along in order to ring fence and protect a certain halachic value. Source number two we also saw last week, and it's basically more of the same. Again, we're not looking at the whole source, but just the key point for this is Bnei Baishan Nahug Delahave Azlan Mitzol Litzidon B'Ma'ala Shabta. So the Bnei Baishan, again, share number four will really understand it. Does that mean the children of this man called Baishan or the citizens of a place called Beit Shan? But nonetheless, there is this custom that they would not go on to the market on Erev Shabbat. they would not travel this distance, however vast this distance may be, again, because you want to make sure you can focus on preparing for Shabbat properly. So again, just these first two sources really start to give this idea of essentially chumrat. We're all familiar with the notion of chumrat, stringencies that exist in Jewish law, not because they themselves are mandated. Chumrat are never obligations. You are not commanded to observe a chumrah by definition. Rather, a chumrah, a stringency, is something that comes along in order to ensure that the actual mitzvah itself, the actual prohibition itself, is done or avoided. And that's really what's happening here. That's why they're often called minhagei chumrah or minhagei issa. These are customs that are there to protect against a certain prohibition or to ensure a certain mitzvah is fulfilled. There's another kind of type of these minhagim, which are, they're not necessarily insisting on protecting a certain halacha itself, but a more broad value. And one of the most well-known examples of these are the decrees of Rabbeinu Gershom. So Rabbeinu Gershom lived in the turn of the 11th century, which is a really, again, I'm one of those people who I always look at the date, and when it's before 1066, which was when England was conquered and became England, it's like, that's a really, really long time ago. So that's when he lived. He lived a generation before Rashi. We're talking very, very, one of the most respected and significant medieval Rishonim, medieval rabbinic authorities. And he had a few different decrees that he issued in the year 1000, that banned a few things. The first was banned divorcing a woman against her will. So it used to be that all a husband needed to do was give the wife a get and she had to accept it, which was bad for reasons we'll not get into now. We'll have a whole other series where we'll talk about, the Aguna problem. I worked for the Organization for the Resolution of Agunot for a period of time, so we'll have a whole series where we can discuss that in greater detail, and we'll focus on this as part of that. But that was one of his things, the need that divorce be reciprocal, that not just the husband issue the get, but the wife accept the get. And he also issued a decree against reading people's mail, which I guess was a problem. And the third and most significant was a decree against polygamy. As we know, halacha itself does not forbid polygamy. You can marry, in the eyes of Jewish law, more than one wife. Rabbeinu Gershom, for reasons we won't get into now or discuss, nonetheless banned polygamy. And there's kind of a broad question of, do his decrees, what's the scope of the decrees, which kind of impacts the minhagim and really, really raises source number three. So source number three is from a responsa of the Ran. The Ran is another one of the Rishonim. So I spoke last week about responsa literature. These are questions and answers. You send a question into your rabbi and he gives you a response, and that is essentially a definitive marker of Jewish law. For this responsa and another one, I actually brought in the question because I thought it was an amusing question. So here's the question. Source number three. Katvat. Ruvain nasa isha betzarfat. So Ruvain is just kind of like John Doe, but Ruvain married a woman in France. Shehu makom shenahagu shela lisa shtei nashim mibnei cherem Rabbeinu Gershom. France was one of the places that Rabbeinu Gershom's decree extended to. You can only marry one wife. Vihine atahudar be'eretz Castilla. Makom shenahagu lisa shtei nashim. But now he's living in Castile, a place where that decree was never binding on people. So first of all, let's be honest here. We all know what Ruvain did. Ruvain got married. Ruvain decided to then move to Castile, and he was like, now I can marry a second wife. And everyone around him was like, we're not sure it works like that. You should send a letter to someone. So he asked the Ran, basically, what should I do? I got married in France. I grew up in France, but now I'm living in Castile. Can I now marry a second wife? And the Ran responds with the following. Ubechi hai gavna. This is the second paragraph of source number three. Vadai misha yatsa misham ve'ein da'ato lachzo. And it seems, in such a case, it seems certain that one who moves from a place with no intention whatsoever to return, ein notnin alav chumrei oto makom sheyatsa misham. They are not bound anymore by the chumrat, the stringencies, in other words, the minhagim of the place from which we came. Again, this is a discussion we'll have in a certain sense, shir number four. But then he continues, aval beit din hagadol shehacharim dava echad al kol anshei gliliotav alehem v'al zaram v'kabluhu alehem. But if a beit din gadol decrees something on all the people, their ancestors and their descendants, and it's accepted, eini roe mitoch oto, Mashne, the holchecha she'echad mibnei bneihem mi'otam shacharim hayachal alav ba'odom bimkoma she'emar she'mibnei she'yatzam bimkoma yuhu mesalok hacherim me'alav. I don't see how anyone who was originally part of this decree, who was originally part of this obligation, can suddenly be like, well, it no longer matters to me, it no longer binds me. Because it's not, the decree wasn't made upon a physical location. It was placed upon the people themselves. So what the Ran introduces here is this concept of there are minhage makam. So again, we'll discuss this slightly more in Shir number 4. But there are customs that are dictated across a community, which is the land in which, so it applies to France. It applies to Germany. It does not apply to Spain. But then there are customs that clearly decrees that bind the people themselves. And so even when those people get up and move to another place, it was on the people. When Rabbeinu Gershom decreed that polygamy was banned, he wasn't decreeing it as much for a specific locale as much as upon all the Jewish people to whom he had the power to influence. And so even when they get up and move, they're still under his decree. They're still under his influence. And thus someone who was banned from marrying a second wife, again, this is also to preserve some sort of value, whatever it may be. They can't just move to another place and suddenly marry a second wife, because that destroys the very essence with which the decree was trying to protect. And so what we see here is the Ran introduces this idea, and this kind of touches on your question of there are customs that people create. And then there are customs that maybe rabbis create, but then there are decrees by, and he refers to it as a Beit Din Gadol. That is, you know, the Supreme Court of Halacha almost. When the Supreme Court decrees something, you can get around a judge's ruling in America, potentially. I don't know enough about American law. But in theory, if a judge decrees something in New Jersey, you could move to Massachusetts and be like, I'm in Massachusetts, that law doesn't apply. But if the Supreme Court rules, it applies to the whole country, regardless of where you live. So too, a Beit Din Gadol that makes a decree, you can't avoid that. And so what we see here is this notion of a minhag that develops to protect something. A chumrah, while again in Shir number 4 we'll discuss whether or not, how binding they actually are, nevertheless its scope and its power is vast and is very strong. And you can't just escape it by potentially just leaving the place in which you live. Even though the Mishnah itself acknowledges there are ways to do that, again, Shir number 4. But broadly speaking, we see this very powerful concept of minhage chumra. This idea that halachot, that minhagim that develop in order to protect something, have tremendous power.
So where was the Ran, where did he live?
Spain.
He was in Spain? Yeah. So even though he lived in Spain, aren't you glad we have a MIMO student?
Seriously.
Yeah. So even though he lived in Spain, he said, he's not bound by it. That's interesting.
So, well,
the question is asked in Spain.
Well, so I don't know the answer to this, but also remember, Spain in medieval times was not necessarily Spain like nowadays.
Well, Castile, wherever.
But I'm saying Castile may be in a completely different region of Spain to, you know, the Basque country is very different to Madrid.
So he was the rabbi where this guy Reuben was living at the moment.
Ostensibly, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
What I remember is that he also spent some time in France as well.
I honestly know very little about the Ran. And the awkward thing is, there are so many of the Rishonim that I know so much biographical details. I know Rabbeinu Gershom lived in Metz in France. That I remembered to look up on Wikipedia. But the Ran, I'm not so familiar with his biography. There's usually a Bar-Ilan function where you can click and they give you a biography of everyone. Obviously, the one person I don't click the biography of is the one person I get questions about. That's the nature of these things. But yes.
It's not a crucial point.
Yeah. Another example. Oh, yes.
But it is a bit of a peculiar decision because he says it's really binding on all the people
who were under the decree.
Who are under the decree from France.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not such a major decree that it should be binding on people who were born in Tisdale.
Correct. So Rabbeinu Gershom was one of the major Ashkenazi authorities of the time. Again, his influence upon the Ashkenazi Rishonim, broadly conceived, is tremendous. But in theory, and again, even Yemenites, when they moved to Israel, had to have a special status where polygamy was allowed for the Yemenite community for the first generation that moved to Israel, because Yemenites, which developed entirely in a different halachic world to a lot of the rest of Jewry, the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom did not matter. And there's a broad question nowadays, how long did Rabbeinu Gershom's ban extend? Some people argue only 1,000 years, and that's past now because the year 1000 is more than 1,000 years ago, and they don't use that in order to advance, you know, let's justify polygamy, there are some interesting, and again, this is somewhat relevant to the Aguna question, but there are some interesting applications of whether this ban still exists or not. But the most well-known example of Minhagei Chumrah is source number 4. The Shulchan Aruch says the following in Hilchot Pesach. Eilu devarim sheyotzim bahem yidei chovat matzah. These following may be used to fulfill the obligation that you bake these things, you make matzah. Bechitim uvisaorim uvchusmin uvishibolet shuel uvishifon. There's actually a huge debate over what all these things are. There is a term I learned recently, which is an archaeobotanist. I don't remember the term now that I tried to recall it. But there's a huge debate, which is relevant for Hilchot Pesach, but let's just take it as their normal translations: wheat, barley, spelt, oats, and rye. V'haminchag likach lechatchila chitim. The custom is ideally to use wheat, but the point is these things are not only used for matzah, but these things also become chametz. So you can't have these things if they've become chametz on Pesach. Aval lo ba'orez usha mine kitniyot, the Shulchan Aruch says, but this doesn't apply to rice and other types of legumes, or let's just leave it translated as kitniyot. V'gam einam abarim lidei chimutz, but they don't become chametz. Umuta la'asot mehem tavshalon. This is perfectly permitted to cook a dish involving rice on Pesach. Comments the Rama. The defining Ashkenazi rabbi of Jewry. V'yesh osrim, and there are those who forbid rice and other kitniot. V'haminhag ba'ashkenaz lahachmir v'ein l'shanot. And the minhag is to be stringent, and we do not change it. So what we see here is this is a classic case of a protective minhag. What is the reason why you can't have kitniot? There are a couple of rationales argued, but one of them is due to the way farmers. I'm from an industrial country. I don't know too much about farm. I'm from an industrial city. I don't know too much about farming, but broadly speaking, you grow wheat on a field. You don't always grow wheat on that same field. It's not good for the wheat. It's not good for the field. It's not good for something. And so you switch it up with other things, and that can often be kitniot. And what happens is crop rotation. That's exactly the word. And what happens is it's not uncommon, it's not completely beyond the pale of comprehension, that rice or that kitniot, whatever it may be, has some component of wheat or other matter that can become chametz. And because on Pesach we treat chametz with such sin, chametz on Pesach is one of the most egregious violations one can possibly do. And so because we treat it so seriously, the minhag of Ashkenazim was to not touch anything with a 10-foot barge pole that even looks like it could possibly have ever even thought of wheat in its entire growth of life. So what we see here, though, is the words the Rama uses. It's a minhag, but it's lahachme, it's a stringency. So it's a protective minhag. It exists in order to protect the actual prohibition of chametz. And this is why there is kind of a debate modern day now in kitniot, is how far does this stringency go? Do we apply stringencies to the stringencies, or is it no? It's literally to protect the actual prohibition of chametz. But if there's no concern, then maybe it doesn't apply anymore. We're not going to discuss kitniot now. But we see here that when people are so willing to dismiss the minhag of kitniot, the truth is that it's a hard argument to make because kitniot as a custom is a very serious one. It is. Spoiler alert, these classifications of minhagim kind of go down in their level of seriousness. We're beginning with this one for a reason, because it is the minhagim that are treated the most seriously, with the most level of importance. That's kitniot. Nonetheless, source number 5 is a response of Rav Avadia Yosef. Rav Avadia Yosef only died relatively recently, a giant of the Sephardi world, an immense Talmid Chacham, one of the greatest geniuses of the halachic world. And he is, and again, we have the question at the beginning of source number 5, the first paragraph. Nishalti odot isha ashkenazia, shenisei lebal sfadi, an Ashkenazi woman marries a Sfadi man. Uviyoto bevet aviha haita noheget kemin hag horia b'chol hachumrot shenohagim. and in her father's home they observed all the various chumrat of Ashkenazim. Umehem achilat orez v'kitniot v'pesach shenogim b'hem issa. That included not eating kitniot on Pesach, because they were Ashkenazi, they observed all the minhagi chumra of the Ashkenazi world. Uche'et oto nafsha linhog k'minhag ba'ala levashal orez v'kitniot v'la'ochlam b'pesach. But now she's married to a Sfari, can she cook and eat kitniot on Pesach? Im ein bezemishum al titosh tartamecha, or is it, you know, and it's not a violation of al titosh tartamecha, a violation of minhag. So again, shir number 4 will kind of talk about the broad ideas of what minhagim is one bound to. Is one bound to their husband's minhagim, their spouse's minhagim, their family minhagim, all those details, shir number 4. But for now, the question is, we have an Ashkenazi girl, an Ashkenazi woman who for her whole life has observed the minhagim of Ashkenazi, of the Ashkenazi world, including kitniot. Now she's married to a Sfardi. Sfardim are not bound by kitniot, because as we read in the Shulchan Aruch, it's perfectly fine. Rav Avadia Yosef responds the following. I mean, it's a much obviously lengthier teshuva, but here's the key quote for our purposes, the second paragraph, source number 5. Umikol shekein be'eretz Yisrael usvivoteha. Shekiblu aleihem horot Rambam umaran ha-Shulchan Aruch. Shehem marei da'atrin. So, in any case, in the land of Israel, where this question is coming from, where Rav Avadia Yosef himself lived, where it accepted upon itself the decisions of the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch. So the Shulchan Aruch lived in Israel, like the Ramah who lived in Poland. So the Shulchan Aruch lived in Israel. So Rav Avadia Yosef says, he accepts as a given, but it's also somewhat of an argument he is making, that the land of Israel accepts upon itself inherently the halachic decisions of the Shulchan Aruch over the Ramah. Because they were the Marad da'atran, they are the authorities, the designated leaders of Jewry in that locale. V'alpihem yachanu v'alpihem yisu. This is like a play on a pasuk in Sefer Bamidbar, which is the Jewish people would kind of move at God's word and camp at God's word. So it's used in quite a lot of sources about minhagim to, you know, fealty to kind of rabbinic decisors. So we should, you know, follow them very much. B'vadai sha'isha rashit lahakel k'minhag ba'la asfari. So it's perfectly clear, says Rav Avadia Yosef, for the wife to be mekel, no longer observe the chumrah of the Ashkenazi world, no longer observe the stringency of kitniot, and instead follow her husband's custom. So one thing that bears noting is, on a methodological perspective, one of Rav Avadia Yosef's big ideals was restoring glory to the Sfardi world. Sfardim for many years were treated as second-class citizens in Israel. To this day, in a certain sense, they are. Rav Avadia Yosef's big thing was that Sfardim, we have our own kind of way of learning Torah, we have our own halachic authorities, and he was such an immense halachic figure that no one could really argue with him. So in part, there is a gender is a negative term, but there is a rationale to why he's arguing what he's arguing. He's basically arguing the Ashkenazi Pesach is silly, and we should follow Sephardim, and you know what? Everyone in Israel should follow Sephardim, because Shulchan Aruch lived in Israel. That's part of his methodology. What we see here is his willingness to dismiss the value of kitniot. But in part, it's to do with a halachic debate. Because there is a halachic debate over whether kitniot need to matter or not. It's the Shulchan Aruch versus the Ramah. As Ashkenazim, we follow the Ramah, Sephardim follow the Shulchan Aruch. But this really also starts to introduce the second aspect to minhagim, the second type of minhagim, which are minhagim that arise out of a debate over what the halacha is. So to understand that, take a look at source number 6. So this is from the Gemara in Masechet Menachot. Now this is, the details of this Gemara we're not going to focus on, but the kind of, we're going to terse out the important principle. Anyway, Amar le Abaye le Rav Yosef. Abaye says to Rav Yosef the following. This is obviously again in the middle of a discussion. Va'at lotis tavra dechi amar Rav ar yavach. Do you not follow the opinion of Rav regarding leaving space? This is talking about writing a Sefer Torah. Again, we're not getting into the actual debate over writing a Sefer Torah, but the main thing is you're not following the opinion of Rav here. V'har Rav it le minhaga. Rav would always follow the practice of the people. Whatever the people were doing, he would kind of endorse that approach. V'ha'idna nahug alma bistumat. And the people are, their custom is to do the opposite of what this person is endorsing. Da'amar rabba amar rav kahana amar rav. Im yavo Eliyahu v'yomer choltsin mina'al shomin lo. If Eliyahu were to come, and now we're talking about chalitza. So in halacha, if a husband dies childless, unfortunately, according to halacha, his brother must marry his wife in order to perpetuate the family name. That's called yibum. The way one gets around that is by performing a ceremony known as chalitza. One of the components of it involves a shoe. That's all for our purposes, all that matters. And so what this statement then says is, in the name of Rav, Rav would always say the following. If Eliyahu were to come and say, you can do chalitza with a closed shoe, we'd listen to him. Fine. Ein chotzin besandal, ein shomin lo. If he said, but you can't do it with a sandal, we would say, nope, doesn't matter, we're not listening to you, we don't care that you're Eliyahu Hanavi. Shekva hanahagu ha'am besandal, because the custom of the people is to use, we use the sandals, we're using chalitza, so you can't override this custom. So there's a few different ways this is understood, but one way is that minhag can decide a halachic dispute. There is a certain dispute over, theoretically, there's this theoretical dispute over whether or not you can use a sandal. But they used a sandal, and even if it were to turn out that the halacha were to be the opposite, nonetheless, the minhag decides within halachic debates. Custom dictates which halachic choice we sometimes follow. Minhag decides what's acceptable within halacha or not. And this is really another sense in which minhag often occurs. You have, and again, the halachic process often codifies, often says you must do it this way or you can't do it that way, but there's still plenty of situations where there's a few different options you can choose from. And sometimes you can choose from them, but sometimes there is a custom in some sense or another, which we'll get a better sense of what that means in a second, but there's a custom that develops that we opt for the view of X over Y, and once the custom begins to follow the position of X over Y, you can't just go ahead and start valuing the view of Y once again, because the custom developed to accept the view of X.
It's very powerful because you have this expression, whenever students are doubt halakhically, they say, actually, I've already have them. And he's supposed to be the one who tells us what, and to say that to him, he's supposed to be the one who tells us what God really wants.
So that,
in this case,
yeah.
It just totally turns out.
And that shows that there is something more powerful than that ideal Eliyahu will come and tell us all the halakhot.
Right.
You know, it's a really... Yeah, that's a very important idea. I just want to read the next couple of sources. So to try and understand the contours of this principle of minhagim regarding halachic decision-making, there's a couple of important sources. The first is from Rav Moshe Feinstein, who again died in the 90s in his Responsa Igwat Moshe, some of the most influential responsa for American Jewry at the very least. And he says the following. He's discussing different types of minhagim. And he says, minhag d'machloket. Bidin hu midinei hora. So he's talking about minhagim based on halachic disagreement. And he says the following. Dekodam shenipsaka halacha belishkat hagazit. Before halacha was codified, lishkat hagazit was basically the seat of the halachic supreme court in the Beit HaMikdash, the Sanhedrin, for want of a better expression. But before that, he says, Rashai kol hacham lihorot kedato. It was every, you know, wise person had the ability to decide halacha for themselves. And whoever asked them a question, you asked the rabbi a question, you had to observe what he said, whether this was a leniency or a stringency. If you asked a question, you had to get it. And basically, this, once you ask someone a question and they give you the answer, it's binding on you. You can't just absolve yourself of their decision unless along comes someone else, greater in stature or greater in significance than the previous person you asked the question to, and they say, well, actually, no. Instead, we need to be stringent now, or we need to be more lenient. But nonetheless, this is the principle here of the fact that halachic decisions are made by a rabbinic figure regarding a what might be otherwise a neutral territory. You ask a rabbi what to do, and you ask him what to do, and he tells you what to do. It's now binding on you until along comes someone else, or you find yourself under the authority of someone else who suggests something different, and then that rewrites whatever people used to have to do. Source number 8 is...
The only exception if someone is greater in stature, greater in reputation or learning, that they get to change the...
No. So there are other situations we'll talk about in a second. But, you know, this is kind of the broad kind of conception of it, though, is along comes someone who's clearly, obviously, a better scholar in every single way, and they can definitely, you know, this is the way the language is often used for being able to repeal certain halachic decisions. You need someone greater in some sense or another, but there's this more general notion of coming under a rabbi's authority. Source number 8.
Didn't we just conflict ourselves with number 6 that says the people can decide for some minhagim? We've read sources that says the people decide, and now we're...
Yeah, so the question is when... So again, there can be different types of minhagim, but when we're talking about the people deciding, is it again the people themselves decided, or the rabbinic figures within the people, as in when I would have a guess that, for instance, in source number 6, when Rav says the people decide, he means the rabbis within that locale, as opposed to the people. It just makes sense from a legal, as in we'll see clear examples soon of where the people themselves have decided, but for now at least it does seem to make more sense if we imagine halachic decision making going on, because then it foils with what we'll see later. Mm-hmm. Source number 8 is the Pri Chadash, who has a very significant commentary on Minhagim, just slap bang in the middle of his commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. He has like a whole thing on Minhagim. It was a nightmare to find because it's cited and it's actually really hard to find. Took a while to find it, but he says the following: V'hine emet nachon hadava k'shelo yesh lahem rav aleihem. So what he's addressing here: if you don't have a rabbi, fine. Aval im yesh lahem chacham muvhak. If you have chacham muvhak or a rav, if there's a designated rav for you. Yachol lahorot kula, bedava shahareheim lo lahagukein. He can teach them a leniency regarding something they previously were not lenient on. Ela alpi otoposek lasor kesovrim shadinkach. They didn't used to do it because they had heard a certain halachic decisor thought it wasn't okay to do. But if you now have a new rabbi upon whose authority you are under, he can decide, no, we don't need to follow the concern of person X anymore. Now we can do a different thing instead. Ukevan sheharav yesh lo rayot listor divrei oto posek, eino chayavim lelech ela acha hashofet asher yeh bayamim haheim, v'al piv yachanu v'al pi yisu. So again, this rabbi brings proofs. He has an argument why he's not just like, no, we don't need to do X anymore, now we do Y. But he gives a reason, he gives a rational, a halachic justification. And then he kind of quotes again this idea that you follow, you know, the campings. And he also says, you know, you follow the shofet you are given. You follow the rav you are given. You don't need to worry about other generations of leaders because you follow the rabbi you have. And if that rabbi tells you, he gives you a good argument for changing what you have been doing. And again, this is within the realm of halachic decision making. So it used to be that the shul decided, let's take our shul for example. It used to be that the shul followed position X, which said you do, to give one example, we were talking about the other, you know, last Friday night, Ha'adaret v'hamuna, which we say during Pesukei Dezimra in Nusach Sfad. It's printed in the Siddurim. So it used to be we could argue the shul followed the position of X, where we said it out loud, and along comes a new rabbi who gives a justification for saying, well, actually, we're now going to follow the view of Y, who says we don't sing Ha'adar V'Hamuna out loud. We don't say it out loud, and justifications are given. That's essentially what the Pri Chadash is arguing here. There are minhagim that develop based on a certain halachic position, and the rabbi decides and picks from among them. The rabbi's decision dictates what people should do. Yes?
I'm severely handicapped because I can only deal with the English and not the Hebrew, but going with the English, I think I see a distinction here, which it says that he says because a certain posek believed it not to be permitted. So he's not saying you could have done X and you could have done Y, and we used to do X and now we're doing Y. He's saying this rabbi said that it was forbidden, but his ruling was mistaken, not he picked.
No, so first I translated this. Translations of Gemara are generally taken from the Steinsaltz Koran online translation. Everything else are usually my... And Shulchan Aruch is from like Sfaria. Usually all of the translations are my bad translations. So sometimes I try to use different words to try and not have it like the same word repeating in the same source. So that was not an intentional kind of translation. It's more... And again, we're going to come to mistaken, but it's no. The rabbi believes the position is X. His halachic position. And two examples of this, one is Kiddush. How do you do Kiddush? Everyone does something different. Some people stand for the whole thing. Some people sit for the whole thing. Some people stand on Friday nights for half of it. Some people then sit for the rest of it. And the truth is, you look at the halachic sources and there's different positions endorsed. And you can really go in depth and try to understand and grapple with what seems to be the ideal position. But as I once heard Rav Herschel Schechter, who's one of the major Rosh Yeshiva in YU talking about, he goes, this is not... It's a minhag, but it's not something you feel bound by. His point was that most people, the way they do Kiddush, is not through a halachic specific decision. Very few people sit down like, I will do Kiddush sitting down because of the views of X. Most people just do whatever they do at Kiddush, and sometimes they change things. And Rav Shechter's point was that you don't need to therefore feel bound by your parents' minhagim to do Kiddush, because ultimately there's not a... If you have a better halachic reason for doing a different view, that's what this falls under here. If you can decide for yourself that you'd rather follow a different position regarding Kiddush, feel free to do it. It's a minhag based purely on a halachic decision, and you can choose to change that halachic decision if you come to a position by which you have learned enough to see that, you know, you can do something different. Another fascinating example of this begins with source number 9. And it's from the Gemara in Chulin. As I start reading it, you'll realize it's one of the most influential, important, and well-known, if not by its explicit quote, nonetheless one of the most important sources. Amar Mar Ukva, said Mar Ukva, Ana laha malta chalaba chamra lagabe aba. When compared to my father, I am like vinegar compared to wine. De'ilu aba, ki have achil basra, ha'edna lo have achil gvina ad lamacha ad hashta. Because if my father had meat, he would wait the entire 24-hour period before eating dairy the next time. Ve'ilu, ana bahasudata hulod achilna. So even though I don't eat dairy and meat at the same meal, lusudata acharitna achilna. I wait until the next meal. This is, so there is a prohibition, there is a Torah prohibition of eating meat, cooking eating meat and milk, or deriving benefit from meat and milk. You can't eat them together. The question is, so what's the time period? What's the, you know, when's, so it's a halachic discussion, but the Gemara implies there is some sort of non-specifically legislated custom to wait a period of time. So Mar Ugva waits from meal to meal, what exactly that time is, but nowadays three core customs have developed. One, three, and some sense of six. One is predominantly found in communities hailing from the Netherlands. Three is dominant in England and large parts of America, and some form of six is also very dominant in America and in Israel. One argument, by the way, given for why English people all follow three is because it goes on sudata acharitna, the next meal, and in England you have afternoon tea in between lunch and dinner, whereas, and you put milk in your tea, no, it's true, and you have, whereas you have generally lunch for dinner. But this was actually relevant because, and I asked his permission to share the story, but Doron Chessis, the Chessis family, wait exactly 6 hours between eating meat and eating milk, which is the position of the Bosman or Rebbe. So you finish your meat sandwich at 1:30, the clock starts, tick, 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 tick. Exactly 6 hours later at 7:30, you could begin to have dairy. However, now, Doron was speaking to me about this when he was here, Doron is now in Ma'alei Adumim, in Yeshiva. The Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Ma'alei Adumim is Rav Rabinovich, Rav Nachum Rabinovich, who was an immensely significant Talmud Chacham, a huge rabbinic figure in the Jewish world. He has a different understanding of waiting 6 hours. For him, it's a rough 6 hours. So what Yeshivat Ma'alei Adumim does is lunch is called for 1:15. And fleishiks is always in Israel, the main meal is lunch, so they have fleishiks at 1:15. Dinner, which is dairy, begins at 7:15. Exactly 6 hours after lunch began, but not 6 hours after you finished eating. So he was wondering, what does he do? On the one hand, he grew up in a home which waits exact 6 hours, follows the position of the Bosna Rebbe. On the other hand, he's now in a yeshiva where the Rosh Yeshiva has a different understanding. So I was not giving him a decision, but I was talking about it. So I'm like, this is exactly what we're going to be talking about in the Minhagim Shir, because really what is... So the first question, which we will talk about in Shir number 4, which is one bound by one's parents' halachic positions? Second, is one bound by the halachic positions of a community in which you no longer live at all? When you've moved to Israel, you've made aliyah, you ain't coming back. But the third thing which I said was, this is perhaps a perfect example of a minhag machloket. You have two different halachic positions. The Boston Rebbe believes it's exactly 6 hours. Rav Rabinovich believes it's around 6 hours. So you have two different halachic decisions. Upon whose authority are you now under? You're now under, you could argue, Rav Rabinovich's. He's your Rosh Yeshiva. Also, you never want to be like firmer than your Rosh Yeshiva. It's generally not a good idea to be like, I'm waiting, guys, because my Rosh Yeshiva, not good enough for me. But it's really, it's that central question here. Who's, if you are now under the authority of a different rabbi, the minhagim that come through that avenue of halachic decision making may change. It's no longer applicable. Oh, my rabbi 50 years ago believed I had to do X, but he's no longer. And if you still stay in touch with that rabbi from 50 years ago, if you still see him as your rabbi doesn't have to be the rabbi of your shul, the rabbi of your community. But nonetheless, if your rabbi is a certain rabbi and he has views different to other rabbis you used to follow, there's no reason to feel bound by previous rabbis. You can now, and perhaps must now, follow the views of your current rabbi. And that's really the second type of minhagim that come about through halachic decision-making. So these types of minhagim are very serious. They need to be treated as very important minhagim, but they're also piskei halacha. They are halachic decisions, and so there is a certain limit to the way in which they are binding, because within the system of halachic decision-making, you can opt to follow a different rabbi. So again, something like for our shul is something that I've been kind of trying to discover and unveil, is the difference between the minhagim of our shul and what I'd call the piskei halacha of the previous rabbis. So for an example, I explained kind of my first week, I do not ask the shul to wait for me to finish my amida. I explained the halachic reasons why, but should another rabbi come along, there'd be no reason for him to be bound. That's not a minhag of the shul, that's a psak halacha of the rabbi, which can then be changed by a different rabbi. On the other hand, there are other things which are actual minhag, actual customs of the shul, which don't fall under this rubric. But nonetheless, there's not just what we've seen in minhag chumra, minhagim that, you know, kind of dictate a certain prohibition, but also minhagim that occur from the halachic process itself, from trying to decide between two different options of halachic decision making. That's another area and avenue in which minhagim develop.
But are we allowed to choose per topic a different hashkafa? Because then you get into that problem of you're shopping for your most convenient.
Yeah. So this isn't your shopping for your most convenient. It could be that you're,
right,
you know,
the
when.
Correct,
they always followed their community that. Rabbi. But so, still, it could be, you know, to
for
take...
different topics, you can follow different...
So you could have, in theory, you know a certain rabbi to excel in a specific area of halacha. Like, even for me as a rabbi, who do I turn to with, you know, questions that I don't necessarily know the answer to? I don't turn to the same person with everyone, because there are some rabbis I know, they know conversion stuff like the back of their hand. And there are other rabbis who I know, they know, you know, other things. So, you know, There's no harm with turning to rabbis with different areas of expertise. The issue is you turn to a rabbi, you're like, Rabbi, can I do this? He's like, no. So you're like, okay. Then you go to the next rabbi, you're like, Rabbi, can I do this? And you wait until he says yes. That's the problem. But there's no issue with, at one point, your rabbi was person X. And now, you know, when I was in Israel, my rabbi was one of the rabbanim in the yeshiva. And he was basically the person to whom I turned when I was in Manchester. But when I came to YU and I found myself, you know, one of the Rosh Yeshiva in YU who I was close to, he's the person now I go to with most of my questions. And it's because, you know, I have chosen a different rabbi for Pesach Halacha. So that's an entirely normal thing. And with communities it's slightly different because it's in a certain sense a formal process. Like this shul used to be under the authority of a different rabbi. Now I am the rabbi. So it's... For this shul, the rabbi sets kind of the halachic decisions of the shul, and again, it's within that broad latitude of things that aren't minhagim, but are piskei halacha, or halachic decisions that are within the remit of the rabbi to at least theoretically have an influence on, whether it makes sense to, whether it's the best idea, but at least in terms of the power and authority, the scope kind of, you know, is based on whoever the rabbi is.
I just want to tell a big story. If I could, in West Orange, when they were hiring a new rabbi, one of the things they would ask the rabbinical candidates is they would list a few of the rabbinic decisions of the previous rabbi, of which they were exceptionally fond, and said, "Will you agree to not overrule these choices as a condition of your accepting the job?"
I would not have got that job, because I'm like, torch it all, you know? Yeah, it's a good job. Otherwise, I wouldn't be sat in the seat right now, because I'd have been like, no. This was when I was told that the previous rabbi, someone had told me, changed 43 things for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. I was like, now I have a number to beat. It's kind of, you know, in all seriousness, it's important for rabbis to have a sense of authority. But at the same time, obviously, there's a balance in place. But that's the second types of minhagim. The next few we're going to move through a bit quicker. For the third is customs that define a new practice. These are really fascinating. Two important sources to look at here. The first is from the Gemara in Tanit, which says, describes the following. Rav Iklal of Babel. Rav came to Babylonia. Chazinuhu de kakaru halela bereish yarcha. They saw they were saying halal on Rosh Chodesh. Sava laf sukinhu. He thought to stop them. You don't say halal on Rosh Chodesh. That's clear. Halal is for times of halal. And we've seen in other shurim in the shul the inappropriateness of saying halal too often. Overindulging in halal is a tremendous problem. Once he realized that they were omitting certain parts of halal, they weren't saying full halal, they were doing a custom halal. Ama, no pun intended, but I just realized. Ama shmamina minhag avotehem biyadehem. He realized, oh no, it's the minhag and I dare not stop it. But what we see here is this new custom arose that the people in Babel were doing to say, for whatever reason, we're not really talking about the reasons or not, but a custom developed. The people, again, whether it was the Rav of the town who instituted halal or the people themselves started saying it, it's unclear. But ultimately, this new practice developed to say halal on Rosh Chodesh. And another fascinating example of this, and it kind of raises many questions of its own, but is the Gemara in the beginning of Masechet Beitza, which says the following. V'hashta diyadinan bekviya diyarcha, mai tama avdinan trei yomei. Now that we know the calendar, why do we keep 2 days yontif? By the way, this is one of the most misunderstood areas of halacha. We think 2 days Yom Tov occurs because back in the day they didn't have a calendar, now we do, but they had the calendar even in the times of Chazal, and nonetheless, so this is the question. So now we know the calendar, we know exactly when. You kept 2 days of Yom Tov because there was uncertainty, you had to wait for a sighting in the land of Israel to confirm the day of the month it was, in order to then kind of set the calendar. So the time it took the travelers to arrive to places outside of Israel, they had to have kind of a looser day in order to ensure that they got the right day, what it was. But now that they fixed the calendar, they don't need to worry about that anymore. Mishum deshalchu mitam hisheru b'minhag avotechem b'yadechem. You should observe the minhagim of your ancestors. Zmanim degazru hamalchut gazra v'atay la'kule. So we have also here a fit. So we have the first thing is to say minhag, and you shouldn't stop the minhag. But then it says there may always be a worry that there will be some sort of decree issued by the rulership of these nations, and then people will kind of, the contact between the two, the ability to create the calendar, whatever it may be, it will mess up the system. So best keep it alive, best keep the knowledge of 2 days alive. But more principally here, we have this idea that 2 days of Yom Tov is a minhag. It's the idea that you can have a whole new day of Yom Tov, you create a whole extra of Yom Tov with all its, you know, obligations and all its prohibitions. You know, in theory, the fact that a man does not put on tefillin on a second day Yom Tov, that's a very powerful minhag to be able to turn around and do that. It's a very powerful minhag to be able to insist on kiddush on a day of Yom Tov that isn't technically a day. So we see here, there is a sense of tremendous power to these minhagim, but these minhagim come along to create a new practice. And there's a broader discussion whether one says a minhag, whether one says a bracha on such a minhag. The Rambam says no, Rabbeinu Tam, one of the Bari Tosfot, says yes, you do. One resolution suggested by the Chazon Ish in the 1950s, he passed away in the 1950s, I'm more raising this just as a food for thought as opposed to discuss it in detail, but he says that there is still kind of, these minhagim can actually be attached to some other notion of minhag which gives them power. So 2 day Yom Tov is related to some sort of protecting a value or a halacha. That's why the Gemara is afraid you'll lose the ability to do something involving them. So we protect it. So it's actually really a minhag chumra, unless you can make a bracha on it because a minhag chumra is powerful. And halal on Rosh Chodesh, he argues, is related to the custom in and of itself for women not to do malacha on Rosh Chodesh. That's fascinating because it's the minhag reinforcing another minhag, but there's this idea that really maybe minhagim are completely new, this idea of creating new minhagim, or maybe it's they're still appendices to other types of minhagim that make sense in some form or another. But there are a whole group of minhagim, and this is where we start to move into the more questionable territory of minhagim, which create an entirely new practice previously never seen in Jewish law. The type that we're not going to talk about today is customs that define a practice. We're going to look in detail next week of the emergence of the various nusachei tefillah, the various liturgies. We're going to look in detail about them, how they came to be. Really fascinating, hopefully really interesting for everyone. But now we're going to turn to minhagim that are based on a mistake. because this is really when things start to get interesting, and it's really a shift in the tone towards minhagim. So source number 12 says the following: Bnei Chozai Nahagu de Mafrashe Chala me Orza. They would separate challah from rice dough. So there's an obligation to separate challah from dough. Rice dough is not part of this obligation, but nonetheless, the people of Chozai did so. Atu v'amrulei l'Rav Yosef. So they came so whoever it is who comes exactly, but they come to a major rabbinic figure, Rav Yosef, in the times of Chazal, and they ask him, basically, what to do. Amar lehu, nichla zaraba afayhu. Let a non-priest eat this dough in their presence. AKA, let's do something that clearly shows this is not something you need to worry about. This is unnecessary. We're going to do something that, you know, challah has to be eaten by a kohen, has to be eaten by a priest. So we're going to davka have someone who everyone knows cannot be a priest. He'll eat this dough, and that will be a really big production that will show people this is unnecessary. It's a bit like you will see people nowadays who they will do things kind of on Shabbat, which are so visibly jarring to people, but the whole point is, well, it's not actually a problem for people on Shabbat, so, you know, we can do it nonetheless. I can't, you know, so for example, people for whom they are object to opening cans on Shabbat, people for whom don't think it's a problem to open a can on Shabbat will be like, give it to me, see, no issue with opening the can on Shabbat. This is basically what they're saying to do here. Let's do something which will jar the people to make them realize, no, there's no need to take challah from rice dough. It yaveh Abaye. Abaye protests. Devarim hamutarim ve'acherim nahagu bahem issa. I'ata rashai lahatiran bifnehem. So this is actually a quote we saw last week regarding, and this was really concerning minhagei chumra. Minhagim that occur to protect something, but something that is permitted and others are, you know, are accustomed to creating a prohibition out of it, you are not permitted to do it before them to absolve them of it. The response, amar lo, but that was actually stated only regarding Samaritans. Kavtai my tama mishum de misarche milta hanach inshinami sarche milta. But this was stated because we're worried they'll basically get carried away with the leniency. The Samaritans, Samaritans is maybe a poor translation of this term, but nonetheless, it's a group of people who don't really know what they're doing, and if they see you being lenient with something that they believe to be a prohibition, they'll think that applies to everything. So if they see you being lenient with challah from rice dough, they'll be lenient with all types of challah. In other words, this makes sense. This, you know, if you see a religious person doing something you think is prohibited, and that they do it, your first thought may not be, oh, well, I guess I'm wrong. It'll be, oh, I guess it's not a problem to begin with. And you'll kind of derive from that all sorts of extensions of permitted things. So the same with the people of Chozai. Essentially what, you know, not beating about the bush, the essential here is the people of Chozai are ignorant. They are not, this is a custom that has arisen from the people themselves to do this. There's been no halakhic guidance. They don't really know what they're doing. And you don't want to confuse them because they don't know what they're doing. They're not particularly knowledgeable about Jewish law, so you don't want to confuse people too much, make them do the wrong thing by seeing this grand production. The Rosh, one of the major rabbinic authorities of the medieval times, comments on this saying, Hilkach tzarich lomar sheyish chiluk b'minhagim d'matnitin ayrei b'minhag chashuv shenahagu b'nei hamakom al pi talmid chacham v'talmid chacham nahagim ahem. There's a difference between minhagim that are seriously endorsed by rabbinic leadership in some sense or another. Aval, minhag garua shel b'nei hamedina shenahagu mi'atzman. But rather a bad custom or a foolish custom, maybe even a stupid custom, a mistaken custom. It's definitely not a positive word. But a bad custom. And where the people have been doing it from themselves, muta lahatira and shalom bifnehem. I read that wrong. Aval min hagarosh bnei hamedina shenahagu me'atzmam davar echad muta lahatira and shalom bifnehem. You can't break it in front of them. He suggests this idea that you see people doing a mistake, you don't want to confuse them. Now there's again a certain, it's bad. It's a derma minhag. So ostensibly, you know, the difference might be just doing it in front of them and confusing them versus, again, carefully explaining to them why it's not necessary. But the idea here is that there are plenty of minhagim people are doing completely out of mistake. And you, but the reason they're doing it is because, you know, they have the best intentions. But nonetheless, it's wrong. But as long as it's not hurting anything, which we'll see in a second, but as long as it's not hurting anything, there's no point stopping them. Because if you stop them, you actually run the risk of them misunderstanding what you're telling them isn't a problem. And they'll go ahead and break a whole other load of violations. So if they're taking challah from rice dough, and they see you not doing that anymore, they'll just think, well, challah isn't a thing entirely. And then they'll go and violate the actual, you know, prohibitions associated with challah. And so it's better just let them keep on doing what they're doing. They're not hurting anyone. They're not harming anyone. They're not harming any halachic value whatsoever. Just let them do it. And it's better that they just do it and they remain ignorant than trying to tell them otherwise. Again, the difference might be if one were to carefully explain and sit them down and talk them through and help them understand why, that might be different. But the caution here is just telling people not to do something can lead to problems. But this brings us to the final group of minhagim, which are minhagim that contradict or violate halacha. In the first case, in the case we were just talking about, there's no problem here because nothing's being violated. But what happens if it is? So the Gemara continues. The Gemara that we read in source number 12 continues in source number 14. Ela amar Rav Ashi, chazinan irovan orez achni. If the majority of people eat rice or rice dough products, lo nichle zarba afayhu. We shouldn't have someone eat before them, a non-priest, a non-kohen eat before them. Dilma mishtechacha torat chala minayhu, because that will confuse them and they'll forget the whole laws of chala. Ve'irovan dagan achle. But if they really eat wheat primarily, nichle zarba afayhu. But if they're actually always eating wheat, we should have someone make this clear statement. Because otherwise they're going to be doing the wrong thing the whole time. Their priorities will be mixed up. And we don't want that to happen. We don't want people taking challah from things that they don't need to, and not taking challah from things they need to. So they really, if it's a place where the majority eat wheat, but they're actually always taking challah from rice, you run the risk of them always being really careful to take the challah from their rice dough, but never taking it from their wheat dough, and thus they'll be doing the wrong thing completely. They'll be doing something they don't need to, and they'll be not doing something they should do. And so in that situation, you actually need to get up and do something about it. And this is a response now of the Rosh, source number 15, discussing again minhagim, aval im nahagu bim komot minhag sheyesh bo avera. If there is a minhag which they're doing something which essentially is an avera, yesh lishnot ha minhag, you change that minhag. Afilu hanhigu gedolim et ha minhag de'ein beit din matin la'akor dava min ha'Torah. Even if great people are doing it, because you know what, a beit din can't root Torah itself. So if you see these great rabbis doing something, but it's really halachically problematic, you can stop it. You can do something different. The defense of great people are doing this is not a good defense. Velomi baye minhag shel avera sheyesh lishnato. And this is not just regarding a minhag that's an avera. Aval afilu minhag she'asu l'sayeg o l'harchakav yachol lavo mimenu kilkul yesh levatal minhag. So now we're coming full circle. He says even a minhag that's designed as a chumra, that's designed as a protection, if there's a risk that in some sense it will cause damage, in some sense it will lead to a problem, you can go ahead and you can change that too. So the Rosh not only endorses the approach of changing minhagim that are problematic, that are kind of arise out of nothing, but even minhagim that have a rationale behind them, if it's still going to lead to a further problem, you can change it. You can tell people to do something different. And we see a really... Oh, and then we just have the Pri Chadash, again, his comments on minhagim, where he says, aval source number 16, aval imhaya iso bedava afilu iso derabanan peshita shahaya mevatal haminhag. You can do both biblical, you know, if they're going to violate, even an iso derabanan, we may be like, you know what, it's an iso derabanan, it's a rabbinic prohibition, what's the worst that could happen? No, even if they're violating something that's not so significant, that's not so important in the grand scheme of things, if it's a violation, it's a violation. And we see a great example of this with something some people in the shul have already heard me mention. I mentioned it on Shabbos Shuva on the Friday night. We see both this example, but also this tension inherent in sources 17 and 18. This is from the Shulchan Aruch regarding the halachot regarding Yom Kippur. Ma she nohagim la'asot kapara be'erev Yom Kippurim. people who are accustomed to achieving acquittal, repentance, kapara on Erev Yom Kippur, lishchat tarnagol, al kol ben zachar v'lo ma'alav psukim, they shecht a chicken and they say psukim, yesh limnoa haminhag. We must protest such a custom. A rooster, we must protect such a custom.
We did it here in this room. We did it.
Source, and then let's just skip. Yeah, but let's. So the Shulchan Aruch says Yesh L'Noam Minhag. Let's skip to source number 18 for a second. The Mishnah Berurah comments why Mishum Chashash Darchei Emori, because it's idolatry. It's the idolatrous practices of other customs. This is the original rationale that the Rashba, another medieval authority, really protests the notion of kaparat. So the Shulchan Aruch says you can't do it because it's pagan. It's not something Jewish. So we see here the Rosh's belief. If people are doing something, who cares if great people are doing it? If it's wrong, it's wrong. Yeshlim Noah Haminhag. However, source number 17, the second paragraph, the Ramah, the Yesh Mehageonim Shekatvu Minhag Zeh, great people, great rabbinic figures, have endorsed this custom. V'chein Katvu Oto Rabbi Minha Acharonim, and many of the later authorities, he means later for his day, not nowadays. What we refer to as the Acharonim come after the time of the Ramah, but even within the period of the Rishonim, there are earlier Rishonim and later Rishonim. This is probably what he means, the later Rishonim, who he was very influenced by. V'chein Nohagim B'chol Midnot Elu V'ein L'shanot Kihu Minhag Vatikin. And we shouldn't change this Minhag because it's an ancient one. So this tension present, the Ramah is like, well, you know, if people have been doing it for years. The Rosh was like, if people have been doing it for years, who cares how great they are? Who cares how old it is? If it's wrong, it's wrong. The Ramah seems to have slightly a different view, which is, well, no. If great people have been doing it, essentially, you know, upon their heads be it, but we're going to continue doing it because, you know, they endorsed it, so we feel comfortable doing it. But we see here very strongly, very clearly, this idea that there can be a minhag that exists. And it's not just a mistaken minhag, but it actually runs the risk of violating a halachic principle. And thus we see within the halachic authorities this idea of we must protest this. We must stop it. We must change it. People cannot do this because it violates a halacha. And a final example of this, to find this example, I just used the Bar Ilan program and I typed Minhag Ta'ut into the Bar Ilan program and it returned a bunch of things. This one was an interesting one. It's from Rav Moshe Feinstein. Source number 19. B'davar shebe'ezor mekomot nohagin shekorin et hatochachot shebe'parashat b'chukatai or b'parashat kitavo. So there's this custom apparently that for the tochacha, which are the curses in the Torah, which the custom of most Jewish communities is to say it silently, or to say it very quietly, sorry, very softly. He says, he's talking about these people who they don't make brachot before and after them. Hu minhag ta'ut, the asor lehitaneg kain, and it's forbidden to do such a custom. Ki asor likrot b'Torah b'tzibor, you can't read from the Torah publicly. Af pasuk echad b'lo bracha, even one verse without a bracha. So what we see, and minhag ta'an, you know, in my original shiurim, in the title, sorry, it was sacred practice or stupid custom. And the term stupid was in part chosen because it makes for an exciting title, but in part because this term like minhag ta'ot or minhag garua, it really, you know, it's not just like wrong. It's not just even foolish. There's a certain contempt for such a practice. It's not just that it's a bad idea, but it's stupid. It goes against everything we know to be true. You're violating the super important principle of making brachot on the Torah in order to conform to some custom for some reason. It doesn't work like that. The great defense of minhag works tremendously with things like kitniot. Minhage chumr, if you turn around and be like, that's a minhag. That's an incredibly powerful statement. But if you make that same statement trying to defend the tochacha with no bracha, that's a useless statement. That's just going to get you, you know, not, you know, metaphorically laughed out of the room because that's not, you can't use that claim. And so what we've seen tonight is these varying different levels by which a minhag can be classified. So when something's described as a minhag, and this is very important because you can debate a given minhag which, you know, classification it fits into, there's definitely some fluidity, but when you have the general you, but you have a minhag, well, maybe it fits among the more important classifications, but maybe it doesn't. And that in part dictates what we'll look into in Shir number 4, which is the seriousness with which we must treat minhagim. Because before we really look at how seriously do we take a given minhag, we need to know what type of minhag is it. And if it's the kind of minhag which really isn't important, even more so if it's a kind of minhag which is problematic theologically or halachically to either all Jewish people or a specific group of Jewish people, that minhag is not a particularly powerful custom. On the other hand, if it's designed in order to protect a prohibition, if it's a chumrah astringency, or it's part of a rabbinic halachic decision, that minhag is far more powerful and has far more weight and is far less easy to shake off. You literally have to, you know, as we'll see in Shana 4, if you leave the jurisdiction, that's one thing, but it's much harder to shake. And so with that, we've kind of seen not just the idea of minhagim, which we saw last week, and maybe what motivates them, but now we've understood that there are six broad types of minhagim. Minhagim that protect a given halacha or a value. Minhagim that arise out of the process of halachic decision making, where a rabbi decides to follow X rather than Y, and thus binds it upon all those who ask him or upon all those who he has authority. A minhag that creates a new practice. A minhag that defines a certain practice, we'll look at in detail next week. But then we also have minhagim that arise out of either mistakes, which seem to be far more populist-driven than rabbinically driven. And finally, we have minhagim that arise not just mistaken, but clearly contradict halacha. And as we've seen with all these examples, this is customs that arise, and then they are analyzed by halacha and assessed, and their value is determined, but in part based on what category of minhag they fall into. So with that, if anyone has any questions, I'm going to pause the recorder. But if anyone has any questions, feel free to ask them. But otherwise, thank you very much, everyone. Have a good night. And I look forward to seeing everyone next week when we'll really understand the Nusach Tefillah, how liturgy came to be.